Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm your host, Pam Stack. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Stay with me because I have a very special guest tonight. Don't go away. Like every single year, come this time when we're putting together our best of the year books in the thriller and mysteries category, Terrence McAuley's name comes up every single year. As a matter of fact, he's won. His work on techno thrillers, particularly James Hicks and the University series, is so spectacular that I cannot discount him from any lists that I make. His books are unique. They are action-packed. There are twists and turns that you never expect. And when I tell you that you literally have to hang on to your seat when you begin reading, because it's a wild ride that doesn't stop until the very end of the book. And even then, you're left scratching your head and thinking, what the hell just happened? My friend Terrence McAuley is with me tonight in this very special episode. I'm so glad that you're back, Terrence. Thank you for joining me on Authors on the Air. How are you?
I'm doing great, and thank you for inviting me back. It's always great to be with you.
Thank you. And so you and I are the ones who, didn't go to BoucherCon this year. and so I've been chastising everyone saying, where the hell are the pictures? I got to see the pictures. You know, if nothing else, pictures. So now everybody's finally pouring in their pictures. I kind of sort of miss it, but I'm really more excited for next year, Terrence. I don't know. How do you feel about it?
I'm really happy about it, too. I'm going to be out there as well. Should be a great time. It's always got a – they always draw a great view venue, and a lot of people come who are readers and writers, and it's great to connect with everybody. So that's a
highlight. And I love
the
fact that it's in my backyard next year, so we're going to have a good time. And most likely I'll be at Thriller Fest, so I'll be in your neck of the woods, and I swear to God I have to go on a train ride with you after all your train ride stories. You know, I say that every time you post about somebody that is on the train with you and they ask the most inane questions. It makes me crazy, but I want to go for a train ride with you and like see New York like Terrence McAuley sees New York.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting place. I'll tell you, it's there's something there for everybody.
It really is. I love the city. I really do. And unfortunately, I had to – one of my best friends is my brother, Brian. People know that. I talk about him all the time. And I had planned to go up the first week in September, but a gal named Irma got in my way, and obviously I couldn't go. So next time. And I'll be sure to get a train ride with you when I come up again, probably in November. But
okay.
Let's talk about – A Conspiracy of Ravens. This is the third in the series. I know you had a prequel, but the third in the more contemporary series.
That's right.
I have to say, first of all, that for those who are listening, I love this series so much, starting off with Sympathy for the Devil and then A Murder of Crows and now A Conspiracy of Ravens, that I am willing to gift all three ebooks to three callers to tonight's show. So the number to call in is 347-633-9609. That's all three books, and that is the complete set of books by Terrence McAuley for James Hicks and the University. They're outstanding. I'll even do you one better. I have the first two books in paper. I haven't received my paper copy of Conspiracy of Ravens yet, but I have the first two books in paper. you can have your choice. One lucky caller is going to get the first two books, and then I'll gift you the last one in ebook. 347-633-9609. Give us a call. Terrence, you ramped it up this time. Boy, you really ratcheted up the tension in this book. From the first page, it was done and on. It was game on for James Hicks.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I really wanted to write something a little bit different with this time around in Sympathy for the Devil. What I try to do is introduce you to the world of the university and to the character of James Hicks and to show you a little bit about what he can do. In the second book, A Murder of Crows, I try to introduce you more to the world that he's been living in,
right,
the details about the university, the kinds of threats it's going to be facing, and how Hicks handles different types of adversity, not just from one enemy, but from several. Then
right,
in A Conspiracy of Ravens, I try to tell it a different way. Not only is Hicks directly threatened, and not only is the university directly threatened, but I tell the point of view from various characters who play a key role in the story, because I didn't want to fall into a rut where every book is told from the same point of view constantly. And I didn't want to get bored with writing it. I didn't want the readers to get bored with reading it. So that's why I changed the point of view around frantically for the first time in my entire career. And that allowed me to present the reader with a lot of information while I keep the action flowing, and at the same time showing them the story from different angles. And it was a pleasure to write, and people seem to have liked reading it as well.
You know, the first book, when I first met James Hicks, because just due to the nature of what the university is, he's a master manipulator. And
yes,
and that is his role. He manipulates people for a means to an end, or situations, which is totally appropriate when you read the book. But I couldn't stand him. I thought, what a horrible individual. But
yeah,
then I thought, you know, how does someone become an asset when you are in a covert operation? And an asset doesn't have to be on foreign soil. It actually can be right here on domestic soil. And
right,
that's, I think, why I didn't like him. But then after a while, you realize this is a man who's devoted his life, essentially, and to do what he thinks is right,
mm-hmm,
and to avert the larger crisis.
Right.
So the second book, it's a little bit more personal about him. We learn more about him personally and how his mind works and so on. And I felt the tension growing and growing and growing. And the book is totally and completely satisfying to the end. But now you hit the ground running on this one. Not only had he been predicting the war was going to start, the war has actually begun in A Conspiracy
right
of Ravens. And it
right
is nonstop action. And not everybody comes out unscathed, including the university itself.
Right. Right. Yeah, I didn't want to. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, you didn't want to pull your punches, I bet you, right?
Right. Yeah, I didn't want to pull my punches, and I wanted to show that there was going to be that this really is a dangerous world that I've created, and it's also a dangerous world that we live in. And I wanted to make the story seem as realistic as possible while still being in the realm of fiction. You know, I don't like it when series go on for too long and you can always tell what's going to happen. I also don't
right
want to be accused of jumping the shark either, where you just
right
have something horrible happen to somebody for the sake of shock value either.
Shock, right. Right.
So what I did was I always, when I started the series and I realized I had more than one book in me, I knew that there were certain characters that were going to have an arc, and some were going to have a brighter outcome than others, and some were going to contribute more to the overall arc than others. One of them, without giving anything away, is the character of Tali Sadan, the Israeli
right
agent from the Mossad. She played a minor role in Sympathy for the Devil. In A Murder of Crows, she plays an incredibly central role, and she also, and where she affects the entire story arc of the book. And then
yes,
in Conspiracy
does
of Ravens, she's essential to a lot of what happens in the middle and at the end of the book as well, and she changes the entire arc going forward of James Hicks. So I don't like to have too many characters stay in the background. I like to try to mix it up a little bit. And in this book, I was glad to be able to do that.
Yeah, I like that you've pulled in people from previous books and you've made their you've made clear their reason for being on the landscape. So I don't want to give anything away either. So, you know, whether they were nefarious in the beginning or they were assets, you at least see them again and see how their roles in the book play out. And it's a brilliant bit of story writing. Congratulations on that. Once again, of course, you are on the, you know, the short list for Book of the Year. You know I love your work, and I look forward to reading it.
Thank you.
Do you think that you're setting aside James Hicks and the university for the time being, or do you think there may at some point be another book or two with these characters?
Oh, I've never intended on only writing a trilogy. That's why I keep telling people this isn't a trilogy. This is only the third book that you've seen in the series. There's a in June of next year, Polis Books is going to be publishing what I call the prequel to the modern day university series called The Fairfax Incident. And it's a sequel to a book that I've already written that's already out there. It's called Slow Burn. It's about that one is a 1930s set story featuring a corrupt Tammany Hall detective named Charlie Daugherty, who finds himself a man without a country. His Tammany Hall days are over because reform is coming to the fore. His political, the prohibition is starting to end. The Great Depression is the city by the throat. And he finds himself in the middle of a murder kidnapping case involving one of the wealthiest families in the world. That's Slow Burn. He gets involved in that case as a cop because he figures he can get some hush money from this very wealthy family to try to hide some of the more unsavory characteristics of the death that they're involved in. And it turns out that they're not just wrapped up in this murder, murder and kidnapping. They're actually deeply involved in it because it's their children. So he gets involved in it because he cares about the family, goes against his own bosses to try to solve it, and then winds up at the end of the book being kicked off the force and becoming a private investigator. In the Fairfax incident, he is working for the wealthy family who he helped out as a cop, as a private investigator, and he's tasked with finding out when is a suicide not a suicide, and that's when it's murder. In this case, I'm not going to give away too much at this point, but this case is the whole basis of where the university comes from. And so
I can't wait to read it. Read it.
It's Terrence, set in 1930s.
You like writing 1930s era kind of books, don't you?
Yes, I do.
I think you told me you're very fascinated with that. It's because it's such a pivotal time in law enforcement and just society in general. You like reading in that and writing in that genre, don't you?
I do, yeah, because there was a lot going on then. You know, the country was in great turmoil. It was when the Roaring Twenties ended. The hangover from World War I was finally over and reality set in. The market crashed. People lost their jobs. People had to find other ways to live. People went through incredible poverty and survived and came out on the other side of it a little bit more jaded and a lot tougher than they had been going into it. So I also grew up loving old movies. And as I got older, I started doing research into what it was really like to live back then. So when I did my research, I found out the incredible diversity that was going on back then. I found out a lot about what people did to live, how they were pretty much like we are today. You know, the whole Prohibition era allowed women to cast off the petticoat and go into the bar themselves and have a drink, even though it was illegal. Women weren't just relegated to being with a guy. They could actually go out and break the law just like everybody else did. And you saw a lot of weakening of social norms. You saw a great revival, a great explosion of popular music and culture. And there was also incredible wide-open political corruption that would, even by today's standards, would make your head swim. So there was a lot of turmoil going on in the country back then, and that's why I like writing about it. And that's why my goal ultimately is to continue with taking the university series in modern day ahead, you know, keep talking about James Hicks and to keep talking about the other people that I bring up in the book, and also go back and try to connect the university from the 1930s in the pre-war era all the way up through the Cold War, World War II and the Cold War, and all the way up till modern day.
Let's talk about the Devil Dogs, because this is another story that is somewhat historical in nature. Will you tell listeners about this book, please?
Sure. The Devil Dogs of Belleau Wood is a novella that I did that is completely for the benefit of the Semper Fi Fund. Semper Fi Fund is a nonprofit organization that helps wounded sailors, Marines, airmen, soldiers, anybody who needs it, who used to serve in the military. It's a great organization. A friend of mine who was in the Marine Corps told me about them when I was thinking about doing a World War I novella. And so that's where all of the proceeds go. I didn't get an advance for the book. My publisher of this book, Down and Out, didn't get any money for it either. Every penny that we make off the sales of these books, whether they're ebooks or the print version, goes straight to the Semper Fi Fund. The book itself is about Charlie Daugherty, who I just mentioned. He's at this time he's a patrolman who joined the Marines in World War I. And he finds himself fighting in that infamous battle at Belleau Wood that made the modern Marines the fighting force that they are today, they're known as today. And I didn't want to get bogged down in historical accuracy to the point where the story suffered. I knew I only wanted to tell a novella. Sorry, my Bronx accent got in the way there for a little bit. I didn't want it to sound like telenovela, but I wanted to write a novella that, because I knew that I didn't really want to get into a lot of the historic minutiae, and I knew I couldn't do it as well as a lot of other people have done. So instead, I talk about the battle. I talk about the battle in a whole sense as to where it was fought in the forest, fought in the farms, and places like that. I don't mention specific regiments. I don't mention specific engagements because I wanted to give the reader a flavor of the story. And I didn't want to get to, because I know I'm never going to do it as well as a historian did, no matter how many books I read.
Right, and it isn't germane necessarily to the story. The story stands on its own merit. So, because it's a character-driven story. So let's take a call, okay?
Sure.
Hi, area code 917. You're live on the air. Who's this?
Hi, this is CJ Carpenter.
Well,
hey,
hi,
CJ
Carpenter. How are you? I haven't talked to you in 100 years, it seems like.
I know, but can I say on behalf of a thousand people, we're so glad you're safe and sound.
I know.
Thank you. You're a doll. Thank you. I am so safe and sound that now I'm inviting all thousand of you to come down and visit because I have plenty of room now.
I'll be there next year.
It'll be the party of the year, so come on down.
Absolutely, but very, 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 very relieved that you're doing okay.
Thank you. I appreciate that, CJ.
No worries. But what a wonderful interview. And obviously, Terrence and I have known each other for a few years and everything, and I know his work. And but what I've never asked him, believe it or not, is how do you continue to write and excel your writing when the pressure of the business industry is kind of on our shoulders?
Oh, you mean like the publishing industry, the pressure of the business end of the publishing industry?
And then you excel at you still rise above.
Oh. Well, I mean, for me, what I try to focus on is what I can handle. And as writers, there's only so much of the business end we can do. We have to be cognizant of it, and we have to be able to be willing to help out where we can. But we're not marketers. We're not salespeople. We're writers. And our job is ultimately to tell the best story we possibly can and as efficiently as we can, but in terms of meeting our publishers' deadlines, knowing that they have pressures as well, and then making yourself available as much as possible for opportunities that they have. Some publishers are more aggressively marketing than others, and some writers, believe it or not, I've heard that they hate the idea of going out and trying to market their own work, which I think is silly. I mean, that's, for me, that's the big fun of it all. I mean, you have the solitude of actually writing the book, and then the kick is when you go out and you hear people actually interested in the book and asking questions about the topic, what you wrote on, how you write, your methods. I mean, I find all of that fantastic. That's the payoff. So for me, I just focus on what my job is at that particular point. And 9 times out of 10, it's making sure the book is as good as I can possibly make it, and then focusing on the business end if and when the opportunity presents itself. Because if you do
CJ,
that...
CJ, have you had a chance to read Terrence's books?
Of course, I have all
you're
of them.
Writing.
Of course.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say, you know,
we did a co
book launch together.
I believe it was Sympathy for the Devil, and I had Hidden Vices.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
My second
right.
book, and so we did a co launch right. together. So now I've read everything of his, so I see the progression.
Right.
And
as do I.
Which. Yeah, and you know, and I find it within myself as an author, I have to stop myself from trying to chase the devil. Like, I need it to be as good as the other book.
Right.
And then you have to stop yourself. And that's why I was just curious, as, you know, at what point do you realize that? Because I've stopped chapters and I'm like, no, not working. And I just wondered, you know, and you know, we talk frequently, but we've never talked about that. So thank you, Pam, for having him on, because he's doing a great job.
Well, when are you coming back, CJ? When is your next book due?
Well, I'm 25 pages away, Pam. Lies Kill is my next book.
There you go. Well, you know where I am, and you know where you'll
I
be
know where
when it's ready.
I'm just glad you are where you are.
Thank you, babes. I appreciate it. This is writer CJ Carpenter. If you haven't read her book, she's terrific. Please go and check her out. You can find her on Amazon and all the other online stores. CJ, thank you for calling in. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you, Terrence, for yet again a wonderful, wonderful book.
Thank you very much, my friend. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
You guys have a great night. Okay.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
You too.
Bye.
So, see, you just heard CJ has all Terrence's books. I still have ebooks and paper books to give away. The number is 347-633-9609. I am interested when the next book comes out in to talk about the modern story of the university to see rebuilding and recovering. Now, those words have a very different meaning for me, just having come through a hurricane, than
right.
they do for you. But I know you know what I'm talking about when I say the rebuilding and recovering, because
mm-hmm.
no two organizations in thriller land can go up against each other without a lot of blood being spilled and a lot of brick and mortar, you know, going away. So, I'm really anxious about it, and thank you. But I want to now talk about something a little bit different. Am I allowed to talk about the Westerns?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so you're hearing it first, I hope, but Terrence has signed with Kensington Books to have 2 of his Western novels published. Congratulations, Terrence. Kensington
thank
is a
you.
Great label. I'm thrilled for you. Let's talk about your Westerns, because you have such an interesting, diverse look at the world, and you have so many interests in different fiction genres, which makes you very special and very unique. Tell me why Westerns?
Well, one of my literary heroes was Richard Matheson, who wrote in a lot of different genres.
Right.
He wrote crime fiction, he wrote horror, and he wrote westerns as well. And I wanted to try my hand at all of those. And it's always been my dream to be a published author in a few genres. And so I've got the criminal crime noir under my belt. I've got the techno thriller under my belt, and I've always loved westerns because, in a way, you can tell a purer story with a western because you don't have the accoutrements of technology to rely on. It's usually a basic story that can be very complex because it's character driven. So just
Absolutely.
Because you don't have a lot of the bells and whistles, you do have people at their core, best and worst, because you know. What our perception of westerns has been shaped mostly by 1950s and 1960s television, but
right.
You know, in reality, there were very real people who engaged in a lot of the same challenges we have today. Just like I talked about with people who grew up in the Prohibition era. So it was a very interesting period of time for me. I did a lot of research into well-known personalities who were around back then. And I realized that I might want to try my hand at writing a similar type of character. You know, a lot of people think, when they think of Wyatt Earp, they think of, oh, the gunfight at the OK Corral, and he was a famous person his whole life. And in reality, he wasn't. His brother was. His brother was the big one that everybody knew about. And Wyatt Earp wasn't known as a gunman. He was feared because he would take your gun from you and beat you with it when he was a sheriff. So that gave
really?
Him a complete...
Really? I did not know
yeah.
that.
Yeah, he was not known as a gunman when he went to Tombstone. And I'm sure there's history people listening, they can back that up. He was feared by people who knew him. There weren't many of them who knew him. They knew his brother. But when they heard about him, they gave him a wide berth because they knew he was an incredibly violent guy when he had to be. And he didn't carry a gun most times for Tombstone. He would take yours from you and beat you with it and throw you in jail and not let a doctor look at you. He was a tough guy.
Wow.
And there were a lot of, you know, back then, too, that you had strong women, you had strong people who came from all over the world and were looking for a new life. And they band together to face a lot of the hardships that were happening out there at that time. And it wasn't just from Native Americans. I mean, I know that makes for good TV series, but it was the elements. It was drought. It was, you know, disease that affects the cattle and crops. And people had to work together to try to see their way through life and to build a new life out there. So that's what I wanted. That's the kind of thing I wanted to tackle when I wrote When Bullets Fly, which is going to be coming
wow.
out from Kensington. To use a movie comparison, it's more like The Alamo meets Josie Wales. So it's
okay.
Yeah, it's about a character named Aaron McKay, who's the sheriff in a small town in Montana called Dover Plains, Dover Station rather, and the town comes under siege by a renegade group of marauders, if you will, criminals who decide that they're going to take on the town, and McKay has to coordinate the effort to fight them off and then chase them down afterwards.
It sounds fascinating. And, you know, of course, the movie Tombstone means a lot to me because, you know, I have a fascination with Sam Elliott, who played Wyatt Earp's brother. So I'm going to have to read it even. And I actually like westerns very much, but I'm real selective about which ones I like. So, you know, I might be reading that really soon. Is there any other genre you'd like to try? Because you're so talented with so many different of the fiction genres. Do you think you'd ever like to do horror or science fiction or anything like that?
Yeah, I tried my hand at science fiction. There's it was called the Gatekeeper series. It was published by a small publisher called Prose a couple of years ago.
Right, I remember them.
Yeah, and they're still around, and they
right.
They published two of my sci-fi novellas about prison base Luna, which the moon becomes a prison base and nearly forgotten because everybody is focused on Mars. And so that one was that was a lot of fun to write. I'd like to maybe think about expounding on that book and take those two mini books and making them into a full novel at some point. I'd love to try my hand at horror. I've got a couple of ideas about that. The idea for two novels. One, my wife talked me out of writing, and the other because she doesn't like horror stories.
I don't like horror either. It scares me.
I know, yeah. But I mean, I plan on giving everything a try and seeing if it's good, and hopefully it'll
Absolutely.
Be good enough for me to send out and maybe get published. But that's
Absolutely.
The goal is to try it a bunch of different ways. So we'll see how it goes.
That's as it should be. I mean, that's as it should be. Because it's fiction, after all. And, you know, some of your crime fiction is very dark. I mean, you've penned short stories for Thuglit and everything else. So it's not like that you're a stranger to blood and guts or anything.
No.
Your stories certainly have enough tension in them and enough action. So there's no reason in the world why you can't change it up a little bit. And it's just world-building skills, which, in my humble opinion, yours are excellent.
Thank you.
To read your books. A joy. I wish that you had. I wish that you wrote faster, but you know, I'm still savoring A Conspiracy of Ravens. And as you know, I read your books more than once, so that will be one for me to cuddle up with my Kindle, and you know, on a rainy weekend day or something, and reread. Conspiracy again, because they're truly magnificent. Congratulations on your success, Terrence. I think you deserve way more accolades than you're getting. And of course, I may be a little biased because I like your book so much, but you really do. I hope people will read your books. And if anyone's listening to this and you're afraid to call into the show, no problem. Go to Authors on the Air on Facebook, or send me an email at info@authorsontheair.com and tell me you listen to the podcast or the live broadcast, and I'll be glad to send you copies of the book. I'll send you, for the first three people, you'll get full sets of books so that
Fantastic.
You can read Terrence's. Now, and here's the most important thing, and Terrence, I'm sure you'll attest to this. You really, when you read a book and you like it, you've got to go and review it. I mean, you know, authors don't get paid unless you're buying the books and reviewing them. I mean, it's a two-part deal here. You know,
right.
They've spent the whole year writing a book and getting it ready for you, and you spend a week reading it. We'll take another 15 minutes and write a review.
Yeah, and I mean, also, too, with the way Amazon works, and Pam, you probably know more about this than I do, once you hit 50 reviews, you tend to wind up on more lists. Like if you
Absolutely.
Go on an Amazon page, you'll see, you know, recommended at the bottom of it. Well,
right.
Once you hit 50 reviews, that's a big deal. And so
it's a very
like,
big
what am I,
deal.
Like Sympathy for the Devil is sitting at 44. It'd be great if I could get six more to push it to 50. They all don't
right.
have to be five-star reviews. They all don't have to be rave reviews. And as a matter of fact, if you spend your money and pay for a novel and you don't like it, you've got every right to voice that, as long as it's a thoughtful opinion. And so,
yeah.
You know what, if people read my stuff, some people haven't liked it, they've given 3 stars, okay, fine, but you know what, they're entitled to their opinion. They've read the book, they've made
Absolutely.
Their investment. I get that.
Right, and that's a legitimate thing, too, and I'm glad you said that, Terrence, because not every book is going to be your cup of tea, but
no.
But reviewing is important as long as you're polite.
Mm-hmm.
You may say whatever you wish, but be polite. Don't become what we in the business call a troll.
Right.
You know, you don't have to make a personal attack against someone. You could just say, hey, it ain't my cup of tea and I didn't like it. And
right.
That's a totally legitimate thing to say. Just like if you go to a movie and someone asks you when you walk out the door, how did you like the film? You go, you know, could take it
yeah.
or leave it. That's okay to say that.
Sure.
It really is. And don't
sure.
base the reason to purchase a book on the number of reviews that you see. Reviews do not equal sales. Just
right.
let me share that information. If you only see 10 reviews or 45 reviews or 100 reviews, that does not mean that book is not good. It just means people have made a choice not to review it. So you
right.
cannot assume anything. You know, Amazon is kind of a beast about these things. And
right.
so just throw your hat in the ring. You don't even have to say your real name. You can just say Amazon reader or Kindle
right.
reader. You don't even have to put your name down. No one can track you down. Terrence is not going to stalk you and find you. I promise you.
Right. Yeah. And also, too, it doesn't have to be long. It's just be one sentence. I really like
one
this
sentence.
Book. I didn't like this book. You give it however many stars you want. But, you know, again, once you hit that 50 review threshold, you do appear on some lists. But just because someone has 10 reviews doesn't mean that they're not good sellers or they're not good
exactly.
books. Just like on Twitter, there's a lot of people there who are international bestsellers, and they've only got about 1,000 people following them. You know,
right.
Meanwhile, a guy who, or a girl who's never been anywhere near the bestseller list has 25,000 followers. So,
right.
you know, it
exactly.
doesn't have one hasn't have anything to do with the other.
It does not. It does not. My friend Terrence McCauley, I am looking forward to seeing you twice next year at least, and maybe once this year. But we're going to be at Thriller Fest, and we're going to be at BoucherCon. And then hopefully you and your delightful wife will be coming to see me in the early part of 2018. I'd love to have you down and not think about books for a while. Thank you so much for being a guest on this special edition. And I'm glad it was you who came on tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me, and stay safe.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. Thank you. Thanks, Terrence. Have a great night, and my love to your wife. And you and I'll talk soon, yeah?
You got it. Thank you very much.
Okay, my friend. Good night. And thanks for listening, folks. Anybody who is interested in reading and reviewing Terrence's books, let me know. That's info@authorsontheair.com. You can find me on Facebook at Pam Stack or go to the radio show page at Authors on the Air. Thanks for being with me tonight. Thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.